need to take decisive action. If we don't do it this session, do you think we can get it done next year during election year? I think we all know the response to that.
On the first day of the special session, compromise seems a distant goal. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, May 18th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, is the dream of a state gas line dying?
Maybe they're Huckleberry Buck and everything is going hunky-dory, but that's not the vibes that I get from talking to people around and people in the industry.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Talk on the first day of the legislative special session focused on whether the House and Senate can compromise on a plan to balance the state's budget in the future. Senate leaders say the House must move in their direction, but House leaders say the Senate must do the same. Independent Governor Bill Walker says he's hopeful the two sides can reach an agreement.
People are doing in this building, including myself, things that it's not about what we want to do, what we like to do, it's what we have to do. And that's sort of the uncomfortable message throughout this building, but it's happening. It's you know, very different than last year.
The House majority supports an income tax or another tax that balances the impact of the budget plan across different income groups. They also want to raise oil and gas taxes. House Speaker Bryce Edgman is a Dillingham Democrat. He says the legislature must not count on higher oil prices or federal spending to balance the budget or help the economy.
We need to take decisive action. If we don't do it this session, do you think we can get it done next year during election year? I think we all know the response to that. So that punts it down to 2019. Can we wait for two more years to do all this? We should be doing this year.
The Senate majority has proposed deeper spending cuts. They also emphasize eliminating oil and gas tax credits that can be cashed in. Senate President Pete Kelly, a Fairbanks Republican, says he's concerned about the effect on the private sector of tax increases. He says he'd like to avoid notices of government layoffs on June 1st, but the legislature must protect the private sector as well.
We don't want families to be frightened. They're going to start having to make decisions, and we don't want families to go through that. But ultimately, that just may be the collateral damage of getting these kinds of larger issues dealt with. Our hope is they don't get laid off.
The Senate adjourned until Monday. The House will meet tomorrow. The head of Alaska's Gasline Development Corporation is in China this week, working to attract buyers and woo investors into supporting a state-run LNG export project. Meanwhile, political support in Alaska for the ambitious project is waning. Earlier this session, House Republicans fired a warning shot, threatening to cut millions from the corporation's budget. Last week, the Senate unanimously voted to strip $50 million from its gas line budget. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Rasha McChesney has more.
The budget isn't done yet, but if the Senate's cut stands, the state corporation tasked with building Alaska's massive liquid natural gas pipeline will be tackling the $45 billion project with only $45 million in the bank. Last week, the Senate moved to divert money set aside for the gas pipeline and instead use the money to hire more state troopers and prosecutors and fund road maintenance. The corporation's spokesperson, Rosetta Alcantara, says the cut could send a mixed message to potential investors.
Yeah, there's a lot of positive movement out there, and from the perspective of potential customers, I don't think that helps the message.
Lawmakers on a House Finance Committee told the Alaska Journal of Commerce earlier this week that they will reverse the cut. But it's another setback for the state's ambitions of a gas line project. The Alaska LNG project would connect two oceans and pipe natural gas from Prudhoe Bay to the Kenai Peninsula, then ship it to buyers in the Asia Pacific. But there has been bipartisan doubt about the project since the state took the lead in late 2016. Lawmakers grilled the corporation about its budget this session, questioning the wisdom of an Iditarod sponsorship and its decision to open offices in Tokyo and Houston. Between the two lawmakers who created the state corporation, one launched an audit of it in December, and the other, Representative Mike Chenault, says he understands the legislature's frustration with the corporation and the project.
I know the people in my community, a number of them are frustrated because they've been told this stuff is happening, and in all reality, it's not. We're not checking things off a list in order to move forward. We're just, the list just keeps getting bigger.
Chenault says he supports an LNG project, but he says the corporation has to prove that it makes good economic sense for the state to continue to invest millions in developing the project.
Maybe they're Huckabee Buck and everything is going hunky-dory, but that's not the vibes that I get from talking to people around and people in the industry.
Chenault says he's heard a lot of confusion and complaints from constituents in his Kenai Peninsula district and hometown of Nikiski. The unincorporated town sits at the end of the proposed pipeline. And Kenai Peninsula Borough Mayor Mike Navarre sent a letter to the corporation earlier this week criticizing its assertion that it will take just 2 years to make it through the federal permitting process and start construction on the project. He says the corporation could be building up false hope for property owners, contractors, and job seekers in the communities that would be impacted by the project. The House and Senate will have a conference committee on the budget, and if the cut stands, Governor Bill Walker could still veto it. Grace Jang, the governor's spokesperson, says he won't comment on the pending cut until it reaches his desk. From Alaska's Energy Desk in Juneau, I'm Rasha McChesney.
Tribes that want to place land into trust, creating Indian country in Alaska, are still waiting to see how the Trump administration will treat their applications. The nominee for Deputy Interior Secretary David Bernhardt suggests history won't be any guide.
I'm excited about having a new slate to start with, if you will, not covered by the legacy of hundreds of years.
Bernhardt worked as a top attorney at Interior during the Bush administration. In those years, the government essentially stopped accepting trust lands. Bernhardt says that was in part due to lawsuits alleging the government mismanaged trust assets. But those lawsuits have now been settled.
I think that anything that happened during the Bush administration regarding land in trust and trust responsibility, I don't think you can look as though at those things without sharing a perspective of that particular litigation and the burdens that were imposed on the Department of the Interior because of it.
The Obama administration made land into trust a priority. In January, it approved an application from Alaska. The government accepted 1 acre into trust from the Craig Tribal Association. Bernhardt said at his confirmation hearing today, he knows of no plans to change the land in trust rules. Bernhardt has been working as a lawyer and lobbyist. Among his clients were oil and gas companies. He also represented the state of Alaska 3 years ago when it sued the federal government in a bid to conduct 3D seismic work in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. The Pebble Partnership announced today it has officially formed a new advisory committee in an effort to expand its engagement with stakeholders. The company noted the commitments of 5 founding members, Willie Hensley, Kimberly Williams, Jim Matty, General Joseph Ralston, and Terrence Rock Salt. Mike Heatwall is a spokesman for Pebble Mine.
We're putting together an advisory committee to help advise us on a range of issues regarding Pebble, everything from engineering to environmental design to community benefits and concerns.
Jim Matty is a past president of the League of Conservation Voters and the National Park Foundation. Terrence Rock Salt is a former deputy assistant secretary of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. General Joel Ralston is a former vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Kim Williams is a former executive director of Nunumta Aluxtai and a chief with the Churyung tribe. And Willie Hensley is a longtime Alaska Native leader who served in both the state House and Senate.
Willie certainly has a great reputation and level of experience in Alaska, is very respected in the Alaska Native community, and also has done a lot of work with the development community and kind of bridges a lot of different kind of stakeholder groups and interests.
Heatwall says one of the first tasks the advisory committee will have is to recruit additional members to finalize a 10 to 12 member group. Members can receive a small amount of pay to compensate for their time, travel, and expense, but can also decline if they wish. Pebble says the participants will not be bound by confidentiality agreements or any other limitation on their rights of public expression, including to speak in opposition to the controversial project.
We wanted to make sure that we had a range of views, everything from maybe proponent to neutral and process focused to opponents so that, you know, we're getting critical input and advice.
Last week, the EPA agreed to back down from a proposed preemptive veto, and Pebble agreed to put a project into the permitting phase within 2.5 years. Pebble says they have a smaller, modern mine plan in the works and a number of initiatives they want to talk about soon with the region. Heatwall says the advisory committee will get to review these plans and offer feedback.
Their advice will be shared with the company, and you know, we're certainly going to try to take as much of that on board as we can, and really pretty wide open in terms of what they can look at and the types of things they can comment to us about.
Heatwall says Pebble hopes to get the committee members together for the first time this summer for a full project overview and a trip out to the site north of Iliamna. After that, the committee will meet formally 2 to 3 times a year and more often by phone or video conference. Pebble has agreed to make the committee's work and comments public, including any recommendations the company does not adopt. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the nation's first Russian immersion graduates discuss the program's benefits.
And there are studies that show that, like, if you have a different language, your brain can work in different ways and it can, you know, open up to information easier.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
Companies like Uber and Lyft could open up shop in Alaska as early as June. The State House and Senate have both passed bills that allow so-called transportation network companies to operate. TNCs allow passengers to book and pay for rides through apps on smartphones. Republican Senator Mia Costello of Anchorage sponsored the bill and says the last step is the governor's signature.
The bill does have an immediate effective date, and if the governor signs the bill, it will go into effect immediately upon his signature. And I do know that the companies that were involved in this process are getting ready to bring on drivers and getting ready to bring on riders.
A few years ago, Uber started doing business in Alaska, but by the end of 2014 was blocked by local and state labor rules. TNCs have faced opposition in Anchorage from the taxi industry, which came out strongly against a municipal rule change to allow the new companies into the market. Senate Bill 14 now overrides any measures that might have passed at the local level, though it does include an opt-out provision for communities if they bring the issue to voters in an election. The bill includes safety measures like federal background checks for drivers. Costello says concern from current cab drivers about devaluing their livelihoods has to be measured against potential new jobs created by TNCs coming into the state.
And I think with any change, and this is an innovative change for transportation, there's going to be some concerns, but I think overall Alaskans realize that this is a positive thing for our state.
The bill received widespread support in both chambers of the legislature and is not expected to encounter resistance as it heads to the governor. Asked at a press availability today whether he'd sign the measure, Governor Bill Walker wouldn't say.
I haven't seen the Uber bill yet, so it hasn't come to us yet, but I'll look at that and make a decision when I see it.
According to Patrick Carter, a lobbyist for Uber, Alaska is the last state to pass a legislative bill allowing TNCs. Carter says, depending on the timeline, the companies may begin operating by mid-June. The Alaska Board of Fish has narrowly voted down a request for additional restrictions on commercial harvest of Copper River king salmon. At a meeting today, the panel voted 4-3 against an emergency petition from the Fairbanks Fish and Game Advisory Committee. Only 29,000 kings are forecast to return to the Copper River this year, and commercial fishers are allocated 70% of a 5,000 king harvest quota. Board member Reed Morsky of Fairbanks contended the weak return and harvest breakdown constitute an emergency.
We have basically 5,000 kings that we're trying to split up between the commercial, sport, PU, and subsistence communities, and I'm very concerned that the equity is not there.
Upriver subsistence users will be limited to 2 kings, while personal use dip netters cannot keep any, and the king sport fishing is closed. Commercial fishermen are also facing restrictions on the Copper River Delta, and Fish Board Chair John Jensen of Petersburg said the situation is not an emergency.
I think the department's handling is cut way back on everybody, not just one user group over another.
The restricted commercial harvest is just getting underway, and board member Orville Huntington of Huslia advised deferring to state managers until the panel formally takes up Copper River issues later this year.
I could see a lot of traditional knowledge there that hasn't even been a part of our plan. And hopefully when we go back in, you know, we're going to be in the cycle, Copper River cycle, this winter, and that would be the time to bring these things up. When you bring it up at the last minute, right before when the fish are in the river, it's never a good idea.
Copper River salmon management proposals will be considered during a Board of Fish meeting on Prince William Sound finfish issues, December 1st through the 5th in Valdez. State regulators are still assessing the environmental impacts of a months-long gas leak in Cook Inlet this spring. It was one of several incidents drawing attention to the fact that many of the oil and gas platforms there were built over 50 years ago. But the state is now saying the explanation is more complicated than that. Elizabeth Harbaugh from Alaska's Energy Desk has more.
From day one, everyone knew drilling for oil in Cook Inlet wasn't going to be easy.
Neither a barge nor a tanker can stand the weight of the ice during the 6 winter months in Alaska's Cook Inlet. Only structures of the toughest steel can withstand such a beating.
That's from a 1965 documentary produced by Shell Oil Company, when the industry was first laying pipe in Cook Inlet. A number of Cook Inlet's platforms were built in the 1960s. Today, the Texas-based Hillcorp is the top producer in the inlet. The company knew what it was getting into when it bought up platforms in the region. Its business model is to give new life to old production. But this business model drew a lot of scrutiny this spring when the company was forced to shut down multiple pipes and platforms after 3 separate incidents. In one case, a gas leak from a fuel line went on for weeks after it was discovered. Icy conditions in the inlet made it too dangerous for divers to repair the line. During this time, watchdog groups brought up Hillcorp's decades-old equipment again and again. But now that the state's had time to investigate, Jeff Merrill with the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation says with the gas leak, aging equipment probably wasn't to blame.
In this case, and as far as we know in any of the other recent cases that we've had in Cook Inlet, the age of the infrastructure was not a factor in the incident itself.
Merrill says the state thinks the gas leak was caused by a big rock that rubbed against the pipe because of Cook Inlet's ultra-strong tides. Based on inspections he's seen, Merrill doesn't think the recent string of incidents means Cook Inlet's old equipment is starting to fall apart.
I'm not feeling like, you know, the system that is gonna, you know, is subject to imminent collapse.
But Merrill says even though it wasn't a factor in the gas leak, the state is paying attention to the fact that many of Cook Inlet's platforms are getting up in years. Linda Giguer, a spokesperson for the Cook Inlet Regional Citizens Advisory Council, agrees that old pipes and platforms are a concern. But that's just one of many worries. The inlet is rife with extreme conditions that can cause incidents like this spring's gas leak. Strong tidal currents, dangerous floating ice in the winter, and heavy sediment loads and rocks that can eat away at equipment. All factors involved in Hillcorp's recent gas leak. There's also a risk of earthquakes and volcanic activity. Giguer says the recent series of mishaps has a silver lining.
Well, one positive aspect of these incidents is that they have focused more attention on Cook Inlet and heightened the public's awareness of all the challenges that exist in the inlet.
The Cook Inlet Regional Citizens Advisory Council is working with the state to review all of the inlet's oil and gas infrastructure. The state says the review should be finished before the end of the year. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration wants to relinquish a tract of potentially mineral-rich property north of Fairbanks. According to a Bureau of Land Management notice, the more than 700-acre plot is part of a much larger area around a NOAA satellite tracking facility off the Steese Highway near Fox. The notice says the land is no longer needed. BLM spokesman Craig McKay says the acreage is undeveloped forest land with a few exceptions.
Several trails across there, and some of those trails go quite far back in Fairbanks history. And there is a power line right away And more recently, Fort Knox Gold Mining Incorporated, the operator of Fort Knox, has been conducting exploratory drilling up there.
The property is adjacent to where the company operates a massive open pit mine. Department of Natural Resources Deputy Director of Division of Mining, Land, and Water, Marty Parsons, says the property has development potential.
The state does have what's called a top filing on this land, and since there are some potential mining claims there, assuming that there's a mineral potential, then the state would request those lands to be conveyed to it as part of its land entitlement.
The BLM's McKay says the agency is taking public comment on the proposal through June 1st.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The spring bear hunting season closed this week in Kodiak, and that means it's time for local biologists to do their bear survey. Every year, they choose a sample area to fly over to get an estimate of the season's bear population. KMXT's Kayla DeRoche has the story.
Kodiak National Wildlife Refuge bear biologist Bill Laycock says the refuge and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game have been doing this type of study since the 1980s, and this year they'll scan two areas in the southwestern part of the island. Laycock says a number of factors play into the timing of the survey, including how warm the winter has been.
We want to maximize the number of bears that are out of the dens. Some bears come out a bit later, especially the sows with the younger cubs. We want to do it as late as possible in the spring, but before leaf out and after the hunting season. So it's kind of a tight squeeze there. You generally got about 2 weeks in there with a little bit of wiggle room.
He says while the last few winters have been especially balmy for Kodiak, this year has been more typical, and the vegetation won't be a barrier to spotting the bears just yet. He says usually boars or male bears emerge in early April,
followed by other single bears of both sexes, and then sows with older cubs, say 1 year old or 2 year old cubs. And then the last to come out in general are sows with what we call cubs of the year or spring cubs, cubs that were born this year that are just a few months old.
Laycock will have a better idea of how many bears are out and about in Kodiak soon. He says if weather permits, they'll fly out this weekend. I'm Kayla DeRoche.
The first batch of Alaska students to spend their entire educational lives in a Russian language immersion program graduated from West Anchorage High School last night. As Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early found out, the students were the first in the nation to complete the program, attending classes in Russian from kindergarten to the 12th grade.
Students walk down the aisle of the Sullivan Arena, filing into their seats, waiting patiently for diplomas they had worked for the last 4 years to receive. But for 17 of the students, they'd received scholastic recognition at a ceremony 2 weeks earlier. The Russian immersion program was designed for American students that began when they were 5 years old in kindergarten. Yelena Farkas is the teacher in charge of the immersion program. She's known these students for most of their lives. She says that when the program began, there were language courses for Russian, but none of them as robust.
We already had high school programs. We already had middle school program. And the only component that was missing, it was elementary component. And when Anchorage School District applied for the FLAP grant, we received it and we started. From all of the states, we're only one who received that grant.
The grant allowed for a Russian language lottery system to be set up that fed students from Turnagain Elementary into Romig Middle School, and finally through West Anchorage High School. Parents would enter their kids into the lottery, and those selected would go through the 13-year program. In fact, the first name picked from the lottery 13 years ago graduated high school yesterday.
Wesley Piskoya.
Wesley Piskoya's parents entered him into the Russian language lottery at a time when the family contemplated whether to stay in Anchorage or move to Soldotna for work.
My mom said, well, let's just put Wesley into the lottery for here. She's really praying hard to God, saying, you need to show us a sign. You need to really show us where you want us. They got a call, I think it was a couple of weeks later, saying, well, Wesley got into the program. And mom's like, great, all right. I guess it's staying here. And then at the very end of the conversation, she's like, oh yeah, by the way, Wesley was pulled first.
Piscoya says the family took that as a very clear sign. During the many years he was in the program, Piscoya says that his classmates became more than faces he saw each day.
More than a community, it's your family. You've known them for 13 plus years, so it's very much a family. I know that I can come to these guys with any problems that I might have with any part of my life, if I have like homework problems or social problems.
Building a community was a huge benefit to another of the immersion program students.
Anastasia Erickson, summa cum laude.
Anastasia Erickson's family is Russian, and she's originally from Tok. They moved to Anchorage for better educational opportunities.
We didn't really have any friends here, any family, and so we figured we should hop into this program. My mom was a teacher at Tok, so, I mean, teaching Russian was a given for her, and it would be a great place for us to start a community and start to get to know people. Coming into something that's Russian, something that we were comfortable with as a family.
Erickson says beyond the intrinsic benefit of learning another language, she found that it also helped her in other classes.
I found that as I continued the program, I've gotten better at math. And there are studies that show that, like, if you have a different language, your brain can work in different ways and it can, you know, open up to information easier.
All of Erickson and Piskoya's siblings are also in the Russian program, as are the siblings of a third student who graduated yesterday.
Parker Roy.
Parker Roy says the program has given her opportunities to both practice learning and teach.
I have three younger siblings who are all in the program as well. So between homework and stuff, my parents, I'll be up in my room and like, Parker, come help. We don't know what this means. And I have to come down and like tell them how to do the homework and help my little brother. And
neither of Roy's parents speaks another language, and they wanted her to have as many opportunities as possible. She says she's been interested in speaking more than just Russian and English.
I took Spanish freshman year, and my teacher said I was really good at it. I didn't fully agree because I'd get confused with my English and my Russian, or my Spanish and my Russian. And I'd have a question for my teacher and I'd plan out what I wanted to say. And then I'd go to ask him and I'd say it in Russian.
Parker says she has dreams of being trilingual and becoming a diplomat after going to the University of Montana. In fact, their teacher, Ms. Farkas, asked all of them in Russian what their post-high school plans were. Wesley plans on working in criminology following his time at UAF in Fairbanks. Anastasia will attend UAS in Juneau, where she wants to learn Tlingit and become an archaeologist. All three plan on using their Russian now that high school has ended.
And you are now officially graduates of the Anchorage School District.
In Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman and Rasha McChesney in Juneau, Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Zachariah Hughes and Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities and in the 40 years of Alaska operations.
And by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.